7 months. He was fanatically determined to make it perfect. Every plant and flower, every stone in every walkway had to be an ideal specimen. Every bonsai tree had to be as exquisitely proportioned and as imaginatively and harmoniously shaped as those in the books about classic Oriental landscaping. He expected me to be as caught up in that project, in every project, as he was. But I couldn't be. Didn't want to be. Besides, he was so fanatical about perfection in all things that just about anything you did with him sooner or later became sheer hard labor instead of fun. He was an obsessive-compulsive unlike any other I've ever encountered. A driven man. And though he was wildly enthusiastic about everything, he actually took no pleasure in any of it. No joy. Because there simply wasn't time for joy.
Sounds like it would have been exhausting to be married to him,
Haldane said. God, yes. Within a couple of years, his excitement about things was no longer contagious because it was continuous and universal. And no sane person can live at a fever pitch all the time. He ceased to be intriguing and invigorating. He was tiring, maddening, never a moment's relaxation or peace. By then I was getting my degree in psychiatry, going through analysis, which is a requirement for anyone considering psychiatric practice. And finally I realized Dylan was a disturbed man, not just enthusiastic, not just an overachiever, but a severe obsessive-compulsive. I tried to convince him to undergo analysis, but for that he had no enthusiasm at all. At last, I told him I wanted a divorce. He never gave me time to file the papers. The next day he cleaned out our joint bank accounts and left, with Melanie. I should have seen it coming.
Why?
He was as obsessive about Melanie as he was about everything else. In his eyes, she was the most beautiful, wonderful, intelligent child who ever walked the earth. And he was always concerned that she be perfectly dressed, perfectly groomed, perfectly behaved. She was only 3 years old. But he was already teaching her to read, trying to teach her French. Only 3. He said all learning comes easiest to the youngest, which is true, but he wasn't doing it for Melanie. Oh, no, not in the least for her. He was concerned about himself, about having a perfect child, because he couldn't bear the thought that his little girl would be anything but the very prettiest and brightest and most dazzling child anyone had ever seen.
They were silent.
Rain tapped the window, drummed on the roof, gurgled through the gutters and downspouts. At last, softly, Haldane said,
"A man like that might—"
"Might experiment on his own daughter. Might put her through tortures of one kind and another. If he thought he was improving her, or if he became obsessed with a series of experiments that required a child as the subject."
"Jesus,"
Haldane said in a tone that was part disgust, part shock, part pity. To her surprise, Laura began to cry. The detective came to the table. He pulled out a chair and sat beside her. She blotted her eyes with a Kleenex. He put a hand on her shoulder. "It'll be all right." She nodded, blew her nose.
"We'll find her," he said.
"I'm afraid we won't."
"We will."
"I'm afraid she's dead."
"She's not."
"I'm afraid."
"Don't be."
"Can't help it."
"I know."
For half an hour, while Lieutenant Haldane attended to business elsewhere in the house, Laura studied Dylan's handwritten journal, which was actually just a log detailing how Melanie's days had been spent. By the time the detective returned to the kitchen, Laura was numb with horror.
"It's true," she said. "They've been here at least 5.5 years,
as long as he's been keeping this journal. And Melanie hasn't been out of the house once that I can see."
"And she slept every night in the sensory deprivation chamber, like I thought?"
"Yes. In the beginning, 8 hours a night, then 8.5, then 9. By the end of the first year, she was spending 10 hours a night in the chamber and 2 hours every afternoon." She closed the book. The sight of Dylan's neat handwriting suddenly made her furious.
"What else?" Haldane asked.
First thing in the morning, she spent an hour meditating.
Meditating? A little girl like that? She wouldn't even know the meaning of the word.
Essentially, meditation is nothing but redirecting the mind inward, blocking out the material world, seeking peace through inner solitude. I doubt if he was teaching Melanie Zen meditation or any other brand with solid philosophical or religious overtones. He was probably just teaching her how to sit still and turn inward and think of nothing.
Self-hypnosis.
That's another name for it.
Why did he want her to do that?
I don't know. She got up from the chair, nervous and agitated. She wanted to move, walk, work off the frantic energy that crackled through her. But the kitchen was too small. She was at the end of it in 5 steps. She started toward the hall door, but stopped when she realized that she couldn't walk through the rest of the house, past the bodies, through the blood, getting in the way of the coroner's people and the police. She leaned against the counter, flattening her palms on the edge of it, pressing fiercely hard, as if somehow she could get rid of her nervous energy by radiating it into that ceramic surface. Each day, she said, after meditation, Melanie spent several hours learning biofeedback techniques.
While sitting in the electrified chair?
I think so, but...
But?
He persisted. But I think the chair was used for more than that. I think it was also used to condition her against pain.
Say that again?
I think Dylan was using electric shock to teach Melanie how to blank out pain, how to endure it, ignore it the way that Eastern mystics do, the way yogin do.
Why?
Maybe because later being able to tune out pain would help her get through the longer session in the sensory deprivation tank.
So I was right about that?
Yes. He gradually increased her time in the tank until, by the 3rd year, she would sometimes remain afloat for 3 days. By the 4th year, 4 and 5 days at a time. Most recently, just last week, he put her in the tank for a 7-day session.
Catheterized?
Yes, and on an IV, intravenous needle. He was feeding her by glucose drip so she wouldn't lose too much weight and wouldn't dehydrate.
God in heaven. Laura said nothing.
She felt as though she might cry again. She was nauseated. Her eyes were grainy, and her face felt greasy. She went to the sink and turned on the cold water, which spilled over the stacks of dirty dishes. She filled her cupped hands, splashed her face. She pulled several paper towels from the wall-mounted dispenser and dried off. She felt no better. Haldane said ruminatively,
he wanted to condition her against pain, so she could more easily get through the long sessions in the tank.
Maybe. Can't be sure.
But what's painful about being in the tank? I thought there was no sensation at all. That's what you told me.
There's nothing painful about a session of normal length. But if you're going to be kept in a tank several days, your skin's going to wrinkle, crack, sores are going to form.
Ah.
Then there's the damn catheter. At your age, you've probably never been so seriously ill that you've been incontinent, needed a catheter.
No, never.
Well, see, after a couple of days, the urethra usually becomes irritated. It hurts.
I would guess it does.
She wanted a drink very badly. She wasn't much of a drinker ordinarily, a glass of wine now and then, a rare martini, but now she wanted to get drunk. He said,
so what was he up to? What was he trying to prove? Why did he put her through all this?
Laura shrugged.
You must have some idea.
None at all. The journal doesn't describe the experiments or mention a single word about his intentions. It's just a record of her sessions with each piece of equipment, an hour-by-hour summary of each of her days here.
You saw the papers in his office, scattered all over the floor. They must be more detailed than the journal. There'll be more to be learned from them.
Maybe.
I've glanced at a few, but I couldn't make much sense of them. Lots of technical language, psychological jargon. Greek to me. If I have them photocopied, have the copies boxed up and sent to you in a couple of days, would you mind going through them, seeing if you can put them in order, and if you can learn anything from them?
She hesitated.
I don't know. I got more than half sick just going through the journal.
Don't you want to know what he did to Melanie? If we find her, you'll have to know. Otherwise, you won't have much chance of dealing with whatever psychological trauma she's suffering from.
It was true. To provide the proper treatment, she would have to descend into her daughter's nightmare and make it her own.
Besides, Haldane said, there might be clues in those papers. Things that'll help us determine who he was working with, who might have killed him. If we can figure that out, we might also figure out who has Melanie now. If you go through your husband's papers, you might discover the one bit of information that'll help us find your little girl.
All right, she said wearily. When you've got it boxed, have the stuff sent to my house.
I know it won't be easy.
Damned right.
I want to know who financed the torture of a little girl in the name of research. He said in a tone of voice that seemed to Laura to be exceptionally hard and vengeful for an impartial officer of the law. I want to know real bad.
He was about to say something else, but he was interrupted by a uniformed officer who entered from the hall.
Lieutenant?
What is it, Phil?
You're looking for a little girl in all this, aren't you?
Yeah, Phil said.
Well, they found one.
Laura's heart seemed to clench as tightly as a fist, a knot of pain in her breast. An urgent question formed in her mind, but she was unable to give voice to it, because her throat seemed to have swollen shut.
How old? Haldane asked.
That wasn't the question Laura wanted him to ask.
8 or 9, they figure, Phil said.
Get a description, Haldane asked.
That wasn't the right question either.
Auburn hair, green eyes, the patrolman said.
Both men turned to Laura. She knew they were staring at her own auburn hair and green eyes.
She tried to speak, still mute.
Alive?
Haldane asked.
That was the question that Laura couldn't bring herself to ask.
Yeah, the uniformed man said. A black-and-white team found her 7 blocks from here.
Laura's throat opened and her tongue stopped cleaving to the roof of her mouth.
Alive, she said, afraid to believe it.
The uniformed officer nodded.
Yeah, I already said, alive.
When?
Haldane asked. About 90 minutes ago.
His face coloring with anger, Haldane said, nobody told me, damn it.
They were just on a routine patrol when they spotted her, Phil said. They didn't know she might have a connection to this case not till just a few minutes ago.
Where is she? Laura demanded.
Valley Medical.
The hospital? Her clenched heart began to pound like a fist against her ribcage. What's wrong with her? Is she hurt? How badly?
Not hurt, the officer said. Way I get it, they found her wandering in the street. Naked, in a daze.
Naked? Laura said weakly.
The fear of child molesters came back to hit her as hard as a hammer blow.
She leaned against the counter and gripped the edge of it with both hands, striving not to crumple to the floor. Holding herself up, trying to draw a deep breath, able to get nothing but shallow drafts of air, she said, "Naked?"
"And all confused, unable to talk," Phil said. "They thought she was in shock or maybe drugged, so they rushed her to Valley Medical."
Haldane took Laura's arm.
Come on, let's go.
But
what's wrong?
She licked her lips. What if it's not Melanie? I don't want to get my hopes up, and then...
It's her, he said. We lost a 9-year-old girl here, and they found a 9-year-old girl 7 blocks away. It's not likely to be a coincidence.
But what if... Dr. McCaffrey, what's wrong? What if this isn't the end of the nightmare?
Huh?
What if it's only the beginning?
Are you asking me if I think that... After 6 years of this torture,
do you think she could possibly be a normal little girl anymore?
Laura said thickly. Don't expect the worst. There's always reason to hope. You won't know for sure until you see her, talk to her.
She shook her head adamantly. No, can't be normal. Not after what her father did to her. Not after years of forced isolation. She's got to be a very sick little girl, deeply disturbed. There's not a chance in a million she'll be normal.
No,
he said gently, apparently sensing that empty reassurances would only anger her.
No, she won't be a well-balanced, healthy little girl. She'll be lost, sick, frightened,
maybe withdrawn into her own world, maybe beyond reach, maybe forever. But there's one thing you mustn't forget. Laura met his eyes.
What's that?
She needs you. Laura nodded. They left the blood-spattered house. Rain lashed the night, and like the crack of a whip, thunder broke across the sky. Haldane put her in an unmarked sedan. He clipped a detachable emergency beacon to the edge of the car roof. They drove to Valley Medical with the light flashing and the siren wailing and the tires kicking up water with a hissing sound that made it seem as if the world itself was deflating. Chapter 6. The emergency room doctor was Richard Pantangelo. He was young, with thick brown hair and a neatly trimmed red-brown beard. He met Laura and Haldane at the admitting desk and led them to the girl's room. The corridors were deserted, except for a few nurses gliding about like ghosts. The hospital was preternaturally silent at 4:10 in the morning. As they walked, Dr. Pantangelo spoke in a soft voice, almost a whisper. She had no fractures, no lacerations or abrasions. One contusion, a bruise on the right arm, directly over the vein. From the look of it, I'd say it was an IV drip needle that wasn't inserted skillfully enough.
She was in a daze? Haldane asked.
Not exactly a daze, Pantangelo said. No confusion, really. She was more like someone in a trance. No sign of any head injury, though she was either unable or unwilling to speak from the moment they brought her in. Matching the physician's quiet tone, but unable to keep the anxiety out of her voice, Laura said, "What about Wraith?" I couldn't find any indication that she'd been abused. They rounded a corner and stopped in front of room 256. The door was closed. "She's in there," Dr. Pantangelo said, jamming his hands in the pockets of his white lab coat. Laura was still considering the way in which Pantangelo had phrased his answer to her question about rape. "You found no indications of abuse, but that isn't the same as saying she wasn't raped." "No traces of semen in the vaginal tract," Pantangelo said. "No bruising or bleeding of the labia or the vaginal walls."
"Which there would have had to have been in a child this young if she were molested," Haldane said.
"Yes, and her hymen's intact," Pantangelo said.
"Then she wasn't raped," Haldane said.
A bleakness settled over Laura as she saw the sorrow and pity in the physician's gentle brown eyes. With a voice as sad as it was quiet, Pantangelo said, "She wasn't subjected to ordinary intercourse, no. We can rule that out, but, well, I can't say for certain." He cleared his throat. Laura could see that this conversation was almost as much of an ordeal for the young doctor as it was for her. She wanted to tell him to stop, but she had to hear it all, had to know, and it was his job to tell her. He finished clearing his throat and picked up where he had left off. "I can't say for certain there wasn't oral copulation." A wordless sound of grief escaped Laura's lips. Haldane took her arm, and she leaned against him slightly. He said, "Easy, easy now. We don't even know if this is Melanie." "It is," she said grimly. "I'm sure it is." She wanted to see her daughter, ached to see her. But she was afraid to open the door and step into the room. Her future waited beyond that threshold. And she was afraid that it was a future filled with only emotional pain, despair. A nurse went by without glancing at them, pointedly avoiding their eyes, tuning out the tragedy. "I'm sorry," Pantangelo said. He took his hands out of the pockets of his lab coat. He wanted to comfort her, but he seemed afraid to touch her. Instead, he raised one hand to the stethoscope that hung around his neck and toyed with it absent-mindedly. "Look, if it's any help, well, in my opinion, she wasn't molested. I can't prove it. I just feel it. Besides, it's highly unusual for a child to be molested without being bruised, cut, or visibly hurt in some way. The fact that she's unmarked would tend to indicate she wasn't touched. Really, I'd bet on it." He smiled at her. At least she thought it was a smile, although it looked more like a wince. I'd bet a year of my life on it. Fighting back tears, Laura said, "But if she wasn't molested, why was she wandering around naked in the street?" The answer to that question occurred to her even as she spoke. It occurred to Dan Haldane, too. He said, "She must have been in the sensory deprivation chamber when the killer, or killers, walked into that house. She would have been naked in the tank."
"Sensory deprivation?"
Pentangelo asked, raising his eyebrows. To Haldane, Laura said, "Maybe that's why she wasn't killed along with everyone else. Maybe the killer didn't know she was there, in the tank."
"Maybe," Haldane said.
With swiftly growing hope, Laura said, "And she must have gotten out of the tank after the killer left. If she saw the bodies, all the blood, that would have been so traumatic it would sure explain her dazed condition." Pentangelo looked curiously at Lieutenant Haldane.
"This must be a very strange case."
"Very," the detective said.
Suddenly, Laura was no longer afraid of opening the door to Melanie's room. She started to push it inward. Halting her with a hand on her shoulder, Dr. Pentangelo said,
"One more thing."
Laura waited apprehensively while the young doctor searched for the least painful words with which to convey some last bit of bad news. She knew it would be bad. She could see it in his face, for he was too inexperienced to maintain a suitably bland expression of professional detachment. He said, "This state she's in, I called it a trance before, but that's not exactly right. It's almost catatonic. It's a state very similar to what you sometimes see in autistic children when they're going through their most passive moods." Laura's mouth was exceedingly dry, as if she'd spent the last half hour eating sand. There was a metallic taste of fear as well.
"Say it, Dr. Pentangelo. Don't mince words. I'm a doctor myself, a psychiatrist. Whatever you've got to tell me, I can handle it."
Speaking rapidly now, words running together, anxious to deliver the bad news and be done with it, he said, "Autism, mental disorders in general, they really aren't my field. Evidently they're more yours, so I probably shouldn't say anything at all about this. But I want you to be prepared when you go in there. Her withdrawal, her silence, her detachment, well, I don't think this condition is going to go away quickly or easily. I think she's been through something damned traumatic, and she's turned inward to escape from the memory. Bringing her back is going to take tremendous patience."
"And maybe she'll never come back?" Laura asked.
Pentangelo shook his head, fingered his red-brown beard, tugged on his stethoscope.
"No, no, I didn't say that. But it's what you were thinking."
His silence was a wounding confirmation.
Laura finally pushed open the door and went into the room with the doctor and the detective close behind her. Rain beat on the only window. The sound seemed like the wings of nocturnal birds beating in a frenzy against the glass. Far off in the night, out toward the unseen ocean, lightning pulsed twice, three times, then died in the darkness. Of the two beds, the one nearer the window was empty, and that half of the room was dark. A light was on above the first bed, and a child lay under the sheets, in a standard-issue hospital gown, her head resting on a single pillow. The upper end of the bed was tilted, raising and angling the girl's body so her face was entirely visible when Laura entered the room. It was Melanie. Laura had no doubt about that. The girl had inherited her mother's hair, nose, delicate jawline. She had her father's brow and cheekbones. Her eyes were the same shade of green as Laura's, but deeply set, like Dylan's. During the past 6 years, she'd become a different child from the one Laura remembered. But her identity was confirmed by more than her appearance, by something undefinable. A familiar aura, perhaps. An emotional or even psychic link that snapped into place between mother and daughter the instant that Laura walked into the room. She knew this was her little girl, though she would have had some difficulty explaining exactly how she knew. Melanie resembled one of those children in advertisements for international hunger relief organizations, or a poster child for some rare and debilitating disease. Her face was gaunt. Her skin was pale, with an unhealthy, grainy texture, more gray than pink. Her lips were cracked and peeling. The flesh around her sunken eyes was dark, as if it had been smudged when she had wiped away tears with an inky thumb. The eyes themselves were the most unnerving evidence of her ordeal. She stared at the empty air above her, blinking, but seeing nothing. Nothing in this world. Neither fear nor pain were evident in those eyes. Just desolation. Laura said, "Honey?" The girl didn't move. Her eyes didn't flicker. "Melanie?" No response. Hesitantly, Laura moved toward the bed. The girl seemed oblivious of her. Laura put down the safety rail, leaned close to the child, spoke her name again, but again elicited no reaction. With one trembling hand, she touched Melanie's face, which felt slightly fevered, and that contact shattered all her reservations. A dam of emotion broke within her, and she seized the girl, lifted her away from the bed, held her close, and hugged her. "Melanie, baby, my Melanie, it's all right now. It'll be okay. Really, it will. You're safe now. Safe with me now. Safe with Mommy. Thank God. Safe. Thank God." As she spoke, tears burst from her, and she wept with a lack of self-consciousness and control that she had not experienced since she had been a child herself. If only Melanie had wept, too. But the girl was beyond tears. She didn't return Laura's embrace, either. She hung limply in her mother's arms, a pliant body, an empty shell, unaware of the love that was hers to receive, unable to accept the succor and shelter that her mother offered, distant, in her own reality, lost. Ten minutes later, in the corridor, Laura dried her eyes with a couple of Kleenexes and blew her nose. Dan Haldane paced back and forth. His shoes squeaked on the highly polished tiles. From the expression on the detective's face, Laura guessed that he was trying to work off some of his anger over what had happened to Melanie. Maybe some cops cared more than she thought. This one, anyway. Dr. Pantangelo said, "I want to keep Melanie here at least until tomorrow afternoon, for observation."
"Of course," Laura said.
"When she's released from the hospital, she'll need psychiatric care." Laura nodded. "What I was wondering, well, you don't intend to treat her yourself, do you?" Laura tucked the sodden tissues in one coat pocket. "You think it would be better for a third party, an uninvolved therapist, to work with her?" "Yes."
"Well, Doctor, I can understand why you feel that way, and in most cases I would agree with you. But not this time."
"Usually it's a bad idea for a therapist to treat one of his own children. As her mother, you're almost certainly going to be more demanding of your own daughter than you would be of an ordinary patient.
And, excuse me, but it may even be possible that the parent is part of the problem in the first place." "Yes, you're right, usually. But not this time. I didn't do this to my little girl. I had no part in it. I am virtually as much a stranger to her as any other therapist would be. But I can give her more time, more care, more attention than anyone else. With another doctor, she'd be just another patient, but with me, she'll be my only patient. I'll take a leave of absence from St. Mark's. I'll shift my private patients to some colleagues for a few weeks, or even months. I won't expect fast progress from her, because I'll have all the time in the world. Melanie is going to get all of me, everything I have to offer as a doctor, as a psychiatrist, and all the love I have to offer as a mother." Pantangelo seemed on the verge of issuing another warning or offering more advice, but he decided against it. "Well, good luck." "Thank you."
When the physician was gone, leaving Laura and Haldane alone in the silent, antiseptic-scented corridor, the detective said, "It's a big job." "I can handle it."
"I'm sure you can."
"She'll get well."
"I hope she does."
At the nurse's station, at the end of the hall, a muffled phone rang twice. Haldane said, "I've sent for a uniformed officer, just in case Melanie witnessed the murders, in case someone might be looking for her. I thought it was a good idea to post a guard. Until tomorrow afternoon, anyway."
"Thank you, Lieutenant."
"You aren't staying here, are you?"
"Yes, of course. Where else?"
"Not long, I hope."
"A few hours."
"You need your rest, Dr. McCaffrey."
"Melanie needs me more. I couldn't sleep anyway."
He said, "But if she's coming home tomorrow, won't you have to get things ready for her?" Laura blinked.
"Oh. I hadn't thought about that. I'll have to prepare a bedroom. She can't sleep in a crib any longer."
"Better go home," he said gently.
"In a little while," she agreed, "but not to sleep. I can't sleep. I'll leave her alone here just long enough to get the house ready for her homecoming."
"I hate to bring it up, but I'd like to get blood samples from you and Melanie."
The request puzzled her.
"Why?"
He hesitated.
"Well, with samples of your blood, your husband's, and the girl's, we can pretty much pin down for sure whether she's your daughter."
"No need for that."
"It's the easiest way."
"I said there's no need for that," she told him irritably. "She's Melanie. She's my little girl. I know it."
"I know how you feel," he said sympathetically. "I understand. I'm sure she's your daughter, but since you haven't seen her in 6 years, 6 years in which she's changed a great deal, and since she can't speak for herself, we're going to need some proof, not just your instincts, or the juvenile court is going to put her in the state's custody. You don't want that, do you?"
"My God, no.
Dr. Pantangelo tells me they've already got a sample of the girl's blood. It'll take only a minute to draw a few cc's of yours."
"All right. But where?"
"There's an examination room next to the nurse's station."
Laura looked apprehensively at the closed door to Melanie's room.
"Can we wait until the guard comes?"
"Of course." He leaned against the wall. Laura just stood there, staring at the door. The glass-smooth silence became unbearable.
To break it, she said, "I was right, wasn't I?"
"About what?"
"Earlier, I said maybe the nightmare wouldn't be over when we found Melanie. That maybe it would be just beginning."
"Yeah, you were right. But at least it is a beginning." She knew what he meant. They might have found Melanie's body with the other three, battered, dead. This was better. Frightening, perplexing, depressing. But definitely better.
Chapter 7
Dan Haldane sat at the desk that he was using while on temporary assignment to the East Valley Division. The ancient wooden surface was scalloped by cigarette burns around the edge, scarred and gouged, and marked by scores of overlapping dark rings from dripping mugs of coffee. The accommodations didn't bother him. He liked his job, and he could do it in a tent if he had to. In the hour before dawn, the East Valley Division was as quiet as a police station ever got. Most potential victims were not yet awake, and even the criminals had to sleep sometime. A skeleton crew manned the station until the day crew arrived. In these last musty minutes of the graveyard shift, the place still possessed the haunted feeling common to all offices at night. The only sounds were the lonely clatter of a typewriter in a room down the hall from the bullpen, and the knock of the janitor's broom as it banged against the legs of the empty desks. Somewhere a telephone rang. Even in the hour before dawn, someone was in trouble. Dan zipped open his worn briefcase and spread the contents on the desk. Polaroid photographs of the three bodies that had been found in the Studio City house. A random sampling of the papers that had littered the floor in Dylan McCaffrey's office. Statements from the neighbors,
preliminary handwritten reports from the coroner's men and the Scientific Investigation Division, SID, and lists. Dan believed in lists. He had lists of the contents of drawers, cupboards, and closets in the murder house, a list of the titles of the books on the living room shelves, and a list of telephone numbers taken from a notepad by the phone in McCaffrey's office. He also had names, every name that appeared on any scrap of paper anywhere in that Stereo City residence. Until the case was wrapped up, he would carry the lists with him, take them out and reread them whenever he had a spare moment, over lunch, when he was on the john, in bed just before switching off the light, prodding his subconscious with the hope of attaining an important insight or turning up a vital cross-reference. Stanley Holbein, an old friend and former partner from Robbery Homicide, had once embarrassed Dan at an R&H Christmas party by telling a long and highly amusing and apocryphal story about having seen some of Dan's most private lists, including the ones on which he had kept track of every meal eaten and every bowel movement since the age of 9. Dan, who stood listening, amused but red-faced, with his hands deep in his jacket pockets, had finally pretended to want to strangle Stanley. But when he had withdrawn his hands from his pockets to lunge at his friend, he'd accidentally pulled out half a dozen lists that fluttered to the floor, eliciting gales of laughter from everyone present and necessitating a hasty retreat into another room. Now he gave his latest set of lists a quick scan, with the vague hope that something would jump out at him, like a pop-up figure in a children's book. Nothing popped. He began again, reading through the lists more slowly. The book titles were unfamiliar. The collection was a peculiar mix of psychology, medicine, physical science, and the occult. Why would a doctor, a man of science, be interested in clairvoyance, psychic powers, and other paranormal phenomena? He looked over the list of names. He didn't recognize any. As his stomach grew increasingly acidic, he kept returning to the photos of the bodies. In 14 years with the LAPD, and 4 years in the Army before that, he had seen more than a few dead men. But these were unlike any in his experience. He had seen men who had stepped on landmines, yet had been in better shape than these. The killers, surely there had been more than one, had possessed incredible strength or inhuman rage or both. The victims had been struck repeatedly after they were already dead, hammered into jelly. What sort of men could kill with such unrestrained viciousness and cruelty? What maniacal hatred could have driven them to this? Before he could really concentrate on those questions, he was interrupted by the sound of approaching footsteps. Ross Mondale stopped at Dan's desk. The division captain was a stocky man, 5'8", with a powerful upper body. As usual, everything about him was brown. Brown hair, thick brown eyebrows, brown, watchful, narrow eyes, a chocolate-brown suit, beige shirt, dark brown tie, brown shoes. He was wearing a heavy ring with a bright ruby, which was the only spark of color that he allowed. The janitor had gone. They were the only two in the big room. "You still here?" Mondale asked. "No, this is a clever cardboard facade. The real me is in the john, shooting heroin." Mondale didn't smile.
"I thought you'd be gone back to Central by now."
"I've become attached to the East Valley. The smog's got a special savory scent to it out here." Mondale glowered.
"This cutback in funds is a pain in the ass. Used to be I had a man out sick on vacation. There were plenty of others to cover for him. Now we gotta bring subs in from other divisions, loan out our own men when we can spare them, which we never really can. It's a crock."
Dan knew that Mondale would not have been so displeased about loaned manpower if the loanee had been anyone else. He didn't like Dan. The animosity was mutual. They had been at the police academy together and later had been assigned to the same patrol car. Dan had requested a new partner to no avail. Eventually, an encounter with a lunatic, a bullet in the chest, and a stay in the hospital had done for Dan what formal requests had not been able to achieve. By the time he got back to work, he had a new and more reliable partner. Dan was a field cop by nature. He enjoyed being on the streets, where the action was. Mondale, on the other hand, stayed close to the office. He was a born public relations man as surely as Yitzhak Perlman was born to play the violin. A master of deception, ass-kissing and flattery, he had an uncanny ability to sense pending changes in the currents of power in the department's hierarchy, aligning himself with those superiors who could do the most for him, abandoning former allies who were about to lose power. He knew how to smooth-talk politicians and reporters. Those talents had helped him obtain more promotions than Dan. Rumor ranked Ross Mondale high on the mayor's list of candidates for police chief. However, as ingratiating as he was with everyone else, Mondale could find no words of praise or flattery for Dan.
"You got a food stain on your shirt, Haldane."
Dan looked down and saw a rust-colored spot the size of a dime. "Chili dog," he said.
"You know, Haldane, each of us represents the entire department. We have an obligation, a duty, to present a respectable image to the public."
"Right, I'll never eat another chili dog until I die and go to heaven. Only croissants and caviar from now on. A higher quality of shirt stains henceforth, I swear."
"You make a habit of wisecracking at every superior officer?"
"Nope, only you."
"I don't much care for it."
"Didn't think you would," Dan said.
"You know, I'm not going to put up with your shit forever, just because we went to the academy together."
Nostalgia wasn't the reason that Mondale tolerated Dan's abuse, and neither of them had any illusions otherwise. The truth was, Dan knew something about Mondale that, if revealed, would destroy the captain's career. Something that had happened when they had been second-year patrolmen, a vital bit of information that would have made any blackmailer swoon with joy. He would never use it against Mondale, of course. As much as he despised the man, he couldn't bring himself to engage in blackmail. If their roles had been reversed, however, Mondale would have had no compunctions about blackmail or vindictive revelation. Dan's continued silence baffled the captain, made him uneasy, encouraged him to tread carefully each time they met. "Let's get specific," Dan said. "Exactly how much longer will you put up with my shit?"
"I don't have to, not for long, thank God. You'll be back in Central after this shift,"
Mondale said. He smiled. Dan leaned his weight against the unoiled spring-action back of the office chair, which squealed in protest, and put his hands behind his head. "Sorry to disappoint. I'll be sticking around for a while. I caught a murder last night. It's my case now. I figure I'll stay with it for the duration." The captain's smile melted like ice cream on a hot plate.
"You mean the 777 in Studio City?"
"Ah, now I see why you're in the office so early. You heard about that. Two relatively well-known psychologists get wasted under mysterious circumstances. So you figure there's going to be a lot of media attention."
"How do you tumble to these things so quickly, Ross? You sleep with a police band radio beside your bed?"
Ignoring the question, sitting on the edge of the desk, Mondale said, "Any leads?"
"Nope. Got pictures of the victims, though."
He noted with satisfaction that all the blood drained out of Mondale's face when he saw the ravaged bodies in the photographs. The captain didn't even finish shuffling through the whole series.
"Looks like a burglary got out of hand,"
Mondale said. "Looks like no such thing. All three victims had money on them, other loose cash around the house, nothing stolen."
"Well,"
Mondale said defensively, "I didn't know that." "You still should have known burglars usually kill only when they're cornered. And then they're quick and clean about it, not like this."
"There are always exceptions," Mondale said pompously. "Even grandmothers rob banks now and then."
Dan laughed.
"Well, it's true,"
Mondale said. "That's just marvelous, Ross."
"Well, it is true."
"Not my grandmother."
"I didn't say your grandmother."
"You mean your grandmother robs banks, Ross?"
"Somebody's goddamn grandmother does, and you can bet your ass on it."
"You know a bookie who takes bets on whether or not somebody's grandmother will rob a bank? If the odds are right, I'll take $100 of his action." Mondale stood up,
He put one hand to his tie, straightening the knot. "I don't want you working here any longer, you son of a bitch."
"Well, remember that old Rolling Stones song, Ross? You can't always get what you want."
"I can have your ass shipped back to Central."
"Not unless the rest of me gets shipped with it. And the rest of me intends to stay right here for a while."
Mondale's face darkened. His lips pulled tight and went pale. He looked as if he had been pushed as far as he could be pushed for the present. Before the captain could do anything rash, Dan said,
"Listen, you can't take me off a case that's mine from the start. Not without some screw-up on my part. You know the rules. But I don't want to fight you on this. That'll just distract me, so let's just call a truce, huh? I'll stay out of your hair. I'll be a good boy. And you stay out of my way."
Mondale said nothing. He was breathing hard, and apparently he still didn't trust himself to speak.
"We don't like each other much, but there's no reason we can't still work together," Dan said, getting as conciliatory as he would ever get with Mondale.
"Why don't you want to let go of this one?"
"Looks interesting. Most homicides are boring. Husband kills his wife's boyfriend. Some psycho kills a bunch of women because they all remind him of his mother. One crack dealer offs another crack dealer. I've seen it all 100 times. It gets tedious. This is different, I think. That's why I don't want to let go. We all need variety in our lives, Ross. That's why it's a mistake for you to wear brown suits all the time."
Mondale ignored the jibe.
"You think we got an important case in our hands this time?"
3 murders. That doesn't strike you as important?"
"I mean something really big,"
Mondale said impatiently.
"Like the Manson family, or the Hillside Strangler, or something."
"Could be.
Depends on how it develops. But yeah, I suspect this is going to be the kind of story that sells newspapers and pumps up the ratings on TV news." Mondale thought about that, and his eyes swam out of focus.
"One thing I insist on," Dan said, leaning forward on his chair, folding his hands on the desk and assuming an earnest expression. "If I'm going to be in charge of this case, I don't want to have to waste time talking to reporters, giving interviews. You've got to keep those bastards off my back. Let them film all the bloodstains they want, so they'll have lots of great footage for the dinner hour broadcast, but keep them away. I'm no good at dealing with them."
Mondale's eyes swam back into focus.
"Oh, yeah, of course, no problem. The press can be a royal pain in the ass."
To Mondale, the cameras and publicity were as nourishing as the food of the gods, and he was delighted by the prospect of being the center of media attention.
"You leave them to me."
"Fine," Dan said.
"And you report to me, nobody but me."
"Sure."
"Daily, up-to-the-minute reports."
"Whatever you say."
Mondale stared at him, disbelieving but unwilling to challenge him. Every man liked to dream, even Ross Mondale.
"With this manpower shortage and everything," Dan said, "don't you have work to do?"
The captain walked off toward his own office, stopped after a few steps, glanced back, and said,
"So far we've got 2 moderately prominent psychologists dead, and prominent people tend to know other prominent people. So you might be moving in different circles from those you muck around in when a dope dealer gets wasted. Besides, if this does get to be a hot case, with lots of press attention, you and I will probably have meetings with the chief, with members of the commission, maybe even with the mayor."
"So?"
"So don't step on any toes."
"Oh, don't worry, Ross. I wouldn't ever dance with any of those guys."
Mondale shook his head.
"Christ!"
Dan watched the captain walk away. When he was alone again, he returned to his lists. Chapter 8. The sky was brightening from black to gray-black. Dawn hadn't crawled out of its hole yet, but it was creeping close, and it would crest the hilly horizon in 10 or 15 minutes. The public parking lot of Valley Medical was nearly deserted. A patchwork of shadows and evenly spaced pools of jaundiced light from the sodium vapor lamps. sitting behind the wheel of his Volvo. Ned Rink hated to see the night end. He was a night person, an owl rather than a lark. He wasn't able to function well or think clearly until mid-afternoon. And he didn't begin to hit his stride until after midnight. That preference was no doubt programmed into his genes, for his mother had been the same way. His personal biological clock was out of sync with those of most people. Nevertheless, living at night was also a matter of choice. He felt more at home in the darkness. He was an ugly man, and he knew it. He felt conspicuous in broad daylight. But he believed that the night softened his ugliness and made it less noticeable. His forehead was too narrow and sloped, suggesting limited intelligence, although he was actually far from stupid. His small eyes were set too close, and his nose was a beak, and his other features were crudely formed. He was 5'7", with big shoulders and long arms, and a barrel chest that were disproportionate to his height. As a child, he'd had to endure the cruel taunting of other kids who had nicknamed him Ape. Their ridicule and harassment had made him so tense that he'd developed an ulcer by the time he was 13 years old. These days, Ned Rink didn't take that sort of crap from anyone. These days, if somebody gave him a hard time, he just killed his tormentor, blew his brains out with no hesitation and no remorse. That was a great way to deal with stress. His ulcers had healed long ago. He picked up the black attaché case from the seat beside him. It contained a white lab coat, a white hospital towel, a stethoscope, and a silencer-equipped Walther 45 semi-automatic, loaded with hollow-point cartridges that were coated with Teflon to ensure penetration of even bulletproof vests. He didn't have to open the attaché case to make sure that everything was there. He had packed it himself, less than an hour ago. He intended to walk into the hospital, go directly to the public restrooms off the lobby, slip out of his raincoat, put on the white lab coat, fold the towel around the pistol, and head straight to room 256, where they had taken the girl. Rink had been told to expect a police guard on duty. All right, he could handle that. He would pretend that he was a doctor, make up some excuse to get the cop out of the hallway and into the girl's room, where the nurses couldn't see, then shoot the jerk, shoot the girl. Then the coup de grace, a bullet in the ear for each of them, just to make sure they were stone dead. The job done, Rink would leave immediately, return to the public restroom, pick up his raincoat and attaché case, and get the hell out of the hospital. The plan was clean and uncomplicated. There was almost nothing about it that could go wrong. Before opening the door and getting out of the Volvo, he looked carefully around the parking lot to be sure that he wasn't observed. Although the storm had passed and the rain had stopped falling half an hour ago, light fog marked the direction of a gentle breeze and eddied in lazy patterns off from the main current, shrouding some objects, distorting others. Every depression in the macadam was filled with a pool of rainwater, and the many wind-stirred puddles shimmered with yellow reflections of the light from the tall sodium vapor lamps. Except for the drifting fog, the night was perfectly still. Rink decided he was alone, unseen. To the east, the gray-black sky had a pale, opalescent, pinkish-blue tint, the first faint glow of dawn's radiant face. In another hour, the quiet night routine of the hospital would begin to give way to the business and busyness of day. It was time to go. He was looking forward to the work ahead. He had never killed a child before. It ought to be interesting. Chapter 9. Alone, the girl woke. She sat straight up in bed, trying to scream. Her mouth was open wide, the muscles in her neck were taut, the blood vessels in her throat and temples throbbed with the effort that she was making, but she couldn't produce a sound. She sat like that for half a minute, her small fists full of sweat-soaked sheets, eyes wide. She wasn't looking at or reacting to anything in the room. The terror lay beyond those walls. Briefly, her eyes cleared. She was no longer oblivious of the hospital room. She realized for the first time that she was alone. Remembered who she was.
She desperately desired company, someone to hold, human contact, comfort.
"Hello?"
she whispered. "Somebody? Somebody? Somebody? Mommy?" If people had been with her, perhaps her attention would have been altogether captured by them and drawn permanently away from the things that so frightened her. Alone, however, she could not shake the nightmare that had its talons in her, and her eyes glazed over again, her gaze fixed once more on a scene elsewhere. Finally, with a desperate, wordless whimper, she clambered over the safety railing and got out of bed. She tottered a few steps, went down on her knees. Breathing hard, wheezing with panic, she crawled into the darker half of the room, past the untenanted bed, into the corner where friendly shadows offered consolation. She put her back to the wall and faced into the room, knees drawn up, the hospital gown bunched at her hips. She wrapped her arms around her thin legs and pulled herself into a tight ball. She remained in the corner only a minute before she began to whimper and mewl like a frightened animal. She raised her hands and covered her face, striving to block out a hideous sight.
"Don't, please, please, please,"
breathing rapidly and shallowly. With ever-increasing panic, she lowered her hands and squeezed them into fists. She pounded her own breast hard, harder.
"Don't, don't, don't," she said.
She was pounding hard enough to hurt herself, yet she couldn't feel the blows.
"The door,"
she said softly.
"The door. The door."
It wasn't the hospital room door or the door to the adjoining bath that frightened her. She was looking at neither. She was dimly aware of the world around her, but she was focused instead on things no one else could have seen from any vantage point in that room. She raised both hands, held them out in front of her, as though pressing on the unseen door, frantically attempting to hold it shut.
"Stop!"
The meager muscles in her frail arms popped up, and then her elbows bent as if the invisible door actually had substantial weight and was swinging open against all her protests, as if something big pushed relentlessly against the other side of it, something inhuman and unimaginably strong. Abruptly, with a gasp, she scrambled out of the shadow-shrouded corner and across the floor. She went under the unused bed. Safe. Or maybe not. Nowhere was safe. She stopped and curled into the fetal position, murmuring, hopelessly trying to hide from the thing beyond the door.
"The door,"
she said.
"The door. The door to December."
With her arms crossed on her breast, her fingertips pressing hard into her own bony shoulders, she began to weep, quietly.
"Help me. Help me,"
she said, but she spoke in a whisper that didn't carry to the hall, where nurses might have heard it. If someone had responded to her cry, Melanie might have clung to him in terror, unable to cast off the cloak of autism that protected her from a world too cruel to bear. Nevertheless, even that much contact with another human being, when she wanted it, would have been a small first step toward recovery. But with the best of intentions, they had left her alone, to rest, and her plea for solace and for a reassuring voice went unanswered. She shuddered.
"Help me. It's coming open. It's coming open. It's open."
The last word faded into a low moan of pure black despair. Her anguish was terrible, bleak. Eventually, her breathing grew less agitated, less ragged, and finally normal. The weeping subsided. She lay in silence, perfectly still, as if in a deep sleep. But in the darkness under the bed, her eyes were still open wide, staring in shock and terror. Chapter 10. When she got home, shortly before dawn, Laura made a pot of strong coffee. She carried a mug into the guest bedroom and sipped at the steaming brew, while she dusted the furniture, put sheets on the bed, and prepared for Melanie's homecoming. Her 4-year-old calico cat, Pepper, kept getting in the way, rubbing against her legs, insisting upon being petted and scratched behind the ears. The cat seemed to sense that it was soon to be deposed from its favored position in the household. For 4 years, Pepper had been something of a surrogate child. In a way, the house also had been a surrogate child, an outlet for the child-rearing energies that Laura couldn't direct toward her own little girl. 6 years ago, after Dylan had run off,